May it please the Court. Susan Robertson again on behalf of Appellant Charles Moore. The issue in this appeal is whether the trial court erred in entering judgment reforming a 537.065 agreement from one that on its face was to protect the defendant's personal assets in the event of an adverse judgment to one that changed the nature to require him to agree to a consent judgment or an uncontested hearing on liability and damages, and to prohibit American Family from continuing to control the defense in the case. The issue is whether the court erred in reforming because there is no question the 065 agreement was silent on the three terms that I just outlined.
Now, at this stage, you're waiving any claim that it's against the weight of the evidence, and your point here on appeal is just in regard to substantial evidence, correct?
The point on appeal is lack of substantial evidence. That is correct, Your Honor. And it is appellant's contention that there is no substantial evidence to support reformation. The agreement, as this court is aware, 065 agreements, if I'll shorten it that for purposes of argument, are very important to plaintiffs and defendants, and reformation is an extraordinary remedy. In this case, the 537-065 agreement is clear that in the event of an adverse judgment, Charles Moore is, pardon me, is required to cooperate with Brittany Hunter in the pursuit of any bad faith case claim against American Family, but it says nothing and is silent about any duty to agree to a consent judgment, uncontested hearing on liability and damages, or to prohibit American Family from defending. Those three are three entirely separate and independent requirements. They are not one and the same, and it is undisputed that the respondent agrees that there is no evidence to support reformation to require Charles Moore to enter into a consent judgment. And that is one of the things that the underlying trial judge ordered. Charles ordered the agreement to be reformed to require Charles Moore to enter into a consent judgment in the pending underlying Franklin County liability case. And the plaintiff, now respondent, will agree that there is no evidence to support that and is not asking for that. And it is appellant's contention that reformation is that reversal of the reformation is required, at least in part, because there is simply nothing to support requiring an 065 agreement to be reformed to require a defendant to agree to a consent judgment. The other two remaining provisions, whether or not Mr. Moore is required to agree to a uncontested hearing on liability and damages, or to prohibit American Family from defending him, are two independent additional requirements that appellant contends were nowhere in the agreement. No documentation agrees to support that, and it is dramatically changing the nature of the 065 agreement, which, as this court understands, these agreements are very important.
Why isn't that just a matter of proof for the trial court to decide? I mean, there was testimony that those terms were intended to be in the agreement.
There is testimony that that is the intent and purpose of this and all 065 agreements, which is not true.
But there was also testimony specifically that that was the intent, that that had been discussions. The one attorney said that they had discussed that, and that was the intent of the agreement, and the other said he couldn't remember what they specifically discussed. So
correct.
Why wasn't that a fact question?
That there is the evidence to support reformation, and it is the appellant's contention that those, as just recited by both of your honors, is in the underlying record. But to support a claim of reformation, it is insufficient. There's not substantial evidence under the standard to support reformation.
When you say under the standard, I mean, mm-hmm. clear and convincing, which you talk about in brief, that's the trial burden of proof. It doesn't have anything
correct.
To do with our standard of review. Correct.
I have not disagreed with that in our briefing.
When there's a dispute in evidence, doesn't the judge turn to credibility? And wasn't
correct.
Your client found to be not credible?
In his recollection, not my client, no. My
the
client's
attorney.
Yeah,
Mr. Moore's attorney.
Yes. I mean, we are talking about a case in which the two signatories to the 065, we're not reviewing their evidence, as we're reviewing the testimony of their two lawyers. And so the lawyer for Mr. Moore, the trial judge found him to be in part not credible in his failure to recall the specifics of whether or not they had agreed to an uncontested hearing on liability and damages. And we have not disputed that. We have been very careful in the standard of review and the recitation of the facts before the court.
I'm unclear why there's not substantial evidence in light of that finding. Are you saying that testimony can never be sufficient for reformation? That you have to have a document? Or what exactly, what line are you saying we should draw as to what's sufficient?
You don't always have to have a document, no.
Okay.
But in this case, where you have the, as admitted by the plaintiff to be, the most material issues that justified, in the plaintiff's perspective, entry into the agreement itself, absent from the agreement. And so you are talking about not just, and there's no mistake in the agreement. Unlike a great majority of reformation cases, the plaintiff will come up here and tell you that the plaintiff wants the agreement as worded, and there is no mistake in the wording of the 065 anywhere, that he wants, she wants, Ms. Hunter, wants enforcement of the 065 as it is worded, everything contained therein. So no mistake in the document, no mistake between the parties. No testimony that there was in the plaintiff's attorney who drafted the agreement in multiple drafts, multiple communications, and multiple conversations, never having contained in the document. It is a dangerous proposition that what you have in the case is a plaintiff's lawyer saying, yeah, we agree to it, and disregard all evidence to the contrary when the agreement itself is silent and there's no mistake within the agreement. And to open that up for 065s, which, and I am trying to stay narrow to the evidence, but also relevant in reality, that these 065, the testimony was unrefuted, that the plaintiff's counsel testified, that's what they all mean. We understood it. You can't parse that away from we agreed. We agreed because that's what they're all intended to mean, and that is simply not the case.
But he's, and in some places he said it was his understanding, but in other places, which they cite earlier in the transcript, they said we talked about this and we intended this. So I understand the trial judge might well not have accepted that testimony, but where they did, are you asking us to create a special rule?
No.
Because normally we defer to that.
No, I'm asking to stand firm on the purpose of the 065 agreements.
Well,
the, stand.
This, what, I mean, what makes this contract any different than any other contract where we assume the trial judges can believe all part or none of the testimony of every single witness that testifies in every case?
Because there still is not, at the end of the day, any mistake within this document. You can come, it's like taking a contract and saying, I will give you an analogy and hopefully answer your question this way. In every virtually every settlement that I enter into on behalf of a defendant that has an insurance company, the insurance company will say, well, every settlement is confidential. We assume that. We understand that, and that's what we understand. If it's not contained within the writing of the document, it's not. To have this case stands for, yes, we talked about it because it was understood, that's what they all stand for, is a very dangerous proposition, because at the end of the day, being careful to stand firm on the standard of review that is binding on this court, you have a plaintiff's counsel saying, well, sure, we agree to it, but it's not contained in the document. The 065 issue is very dangerous in terms of, can you have an 065 silent on the most material, according to the plaintiff?
Well, what do you make of the reference to those cases, to a couple of cases that deal with 065 documents, and saying that those are taken into account? Was that, yeah. I don't know why there was a euphemistic reference, if that was it, to the, what opposing counsel says is the standard 065 agreement, but what purpose did that serve if not to refer to what counsel says is a normal 065 agreement?
What those cases stand for is that the parties, the and plaintiff and the defendant, under certain circumstances may enter into an agreement. It does not necessarily mean, these cases do not stand for, what the agreement must necessarily or implicitly encompass. So can a defendant enter into an 065 agreement with the plaintiff? Yes, but the defendant is always concerned that it might be viewed as a violative of the cooperation clause of the policy.
Of course,
so you
the
have,
statute says that's okay.
But you have to still be careful. And here you have Mr. Moore was represented by Mr. Sanner in the liability case, and always was, and had a defense. It's not the best way to answer the relevance of Butters and the other cases is to show how they are different. This is not a case where I represent American Family and I've tried to intervene, or I'm in a garnishment, or I'm in some other collateral case trying to talk about the effect of the 065 with the underlying parties. Butters was a garnishment. The other case was an insurance company attempting to stay a liability case. In neither case do they stand for what has been the preeminent position of the plaintiff, that we don't have to put that in the agreement because that's what they all stand for. That is the danger of the case, and the plaintiff's counsel said it. So going back to your question, do we look at the evidence in this case? We have a plaintiff's lawyer who said, well, of course we agree to it because why else would my client ever have entered into it? But what's not in the agreement are the three most critical things. It opens the door, very dangerous, that these you want the 065s to be here, you want plaintiffs and defendants to enter into them, you want them to stand. Why would a defendant ever enter into one if all it took was a plaintiff's lawyer saying, of course we agree to it, and a trial judge saying, I don't believe the defendant's attorney who said we did not or I don't remember. The three most critical things, Mr. Moore says he did not, and there's nothing. If I'm going to counsel Mr. Moore on the 065 agreement, and I'm going to walk him through every term, and I'm going to say, you're agreeing to this, and you're signing off on that, and then I'm going to say, oh, but we didn't put it in the agreement. I understand you have to agree to an uncontested hearing on liability or damages or consent, or I can no longer represent you.
But isn't it clear that he agreed to not have American Family represent him because he sent American Family a letter and told them to cease representing him?
He said, after the agreement, but not contained within the agreement, sent a letter and said, I don't trust you anymore. But is there anything in the letter that, even though the letter was sent at the time and close to the agreement being entered into, doesn't say you are required pursuant to the agreement we entered into? The Court of Appeals panel found that that letter being sent didn't mean that that was necessarily incorporated in within the terms of the agreement.
Well, it looks like the Court of Appeals reviewed this case under and against the weight of the mm-hmm. evidence standard as opposed to sufficiency.
That's what the writing judge said at the end, that it was mm-hmm. against the weight, and it is
which assumes that they felt like it, the substantial case was made.
The trial judge, or the Court of Appeals judge.
Correct.
Unclear. I mean, Ivy's very clear on what's.
No, I know, but
you're
trying to make weight out of that opinion that no longer exists, but I'm saying the fact that they got to the analysis that it was against the weight of evidence suggested that they thought there was sufficient evidence.
Suggest, yes. My time is up, but I'll be back.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court, let me start out by reading just a brief part of the letter that was sent by Mr. Horsfield, the attorney who was hired by Mr. Moore to represent him when he was sued by American Family as part of the declaratory judgment action. This was sent on September 4th, the same day that Mr. Moore signed the 537.065 agreement. This was sent to Gene Howe, who was the in-house counsel at American Family, and also John Sanner, the attorney hired by American Family to represent Mr. Moore in the tort action that was filed in Franklin County. Because of American Family's material breach of the contract of insurance, my client has now decided to enter into the 537 agreement with plaintiff in the underlying action in order to protect his personal assets. Additionally, he does not trust American Family or anyone hired by American Family to represent him in the underlying action. Therefore, he is instructing Mr. Sanner, the lawyer hired to represent him in the tort action, to file a motion to withdraw and to notice same up for hearing in the Circuit Court of Franklin County as soon as possible. Stated another way, he fired Mr. Sanner as his attorney. Now, counsel has represented that Mr. Sanner represented him the entire time in the tort action. He was fired in the tort action. My understanding of the Code of Professional Responsibility has been a client has an absolute right to fire his attorney anytime he wants to. I don't know how that letter could be any clearer than it was that Mr. Sanner was terminated in his representation of Mr. Moore as of September the 4th, 2012. His representation ended as of that date. Counsel says there is not clear and convincing evidence that there was an agreement that there was a 537.065 agreement that would call for cooperation in entering a judgment and that American Family would be out. Let me read to you three very brief portions of the transcript, not my interpretation of the transcript, but the transcript itself. This is at page 82 to 83 of the transcript. And this is talking about in late August of 2012, after American Family filed a motion for summary judgment in the declaratory judgment action, seeking a judgment declaring that Mr. Moore had no coverage under the liability insurance policy. Did you have further, and this is Mr. O'Leary's testimony, did you have further discussions and communications with Mr. Horsfield, that's Mr. Moore's lawyer, in late August about that? We did. He believed it was in his client, that's Mr. Moore's, best interest, given the actions that American Family affirmatively took against providing a full defense, that we would discuss with our clients, make our mutual representations to our clients, that we believe was in their best interest. I certainly believed all I wanted for Brittany, the plaintiff, was a recovery, whether it was through an insurance policy or through other means. This was an action taken that I believed was counter to any alleged full defense, so I suggested to Brittany, the plaintiff, that it would make sense again to revisit the issue of the 537.065 and eventually get to a point when it's agreed to that we would have an uncontested hearing on liability and damages, and that American Family would no longer control the defense as to Mr. Moore in our Franklin County case. Question, did you communicate that to Mr. Horsfield in late August? Answer, we had several conversations about that. That was always the intent. That, referring to an uncontested hearing on damages and liability and American Family no longer controlling the defense. We always described and understood that the framework of this agreement was a 537.065. At page 88 of the transcript, again, Mr. O'Leary, was it ever the intention of the parties, as discussed between you and Mr. Horsfield, that duties would arise on Mr. Moore's part only after a judgment against him in Franklin County? Answer, absolutely not. He was to cooperate in the pursuit of all the underlying claims. What do you mean by cooperate? What kinds of things does that envision? Answer, what that essentially means is that he would not put on evidence counter to plaintiff's evidence at the uncontested hearing in front of the judge. He wouldn't cross-examine our liability and our damage experts. That was essentially the extent of the cooperation that we were looking for. Certainly, we weren't asking him to confess a judgment or admit to an amount. That was never the intentions that Patrick, Mr. Horsfield, and I had. This isn't just Mr. O'Leary's unilateral declarations. He's talking about the intentions that Patrick, Mr. Horsfield, and I had as a result of their conversations. Now, this isn't wishful thinking on the part of Mr. O'Leary. It is the fully developed conversations that he and Mr. Horsfield had, and it fully supports the findings that Judge Dowd made in the judgment that he entered in this case. My understanding of the law of the standard of review that this court is articulated in the past is the judgment of the trial court is reviewed in the light most favorable to the result reached by the trial court. That's the standard of review. And when that standard is applied to the evidence in this case, the evidence fully supports the finding by the trial court that the parties agreed that there were going to be two essential parts to this agreement. They were not, unfortunately, they were not written down in the agreement, but the two essential elements that were left out that were included in the reformed agreement were, number one, that the defendant, Mr. Moore, would not offer evidence contrary or oppose the finding of liability or in any way contradict the plaintiff's evidence of damages at a trial on the underlying tort claim, and number two, that the defendant would exclude participation by his liability insurance carrier. And what better evidence of that agreement by Mr. Horsfield and his client could there be of the fact that on September 4th, the same day that Mr. Moore signed the agreement, his lawyer sent a letter to American Family that said, you're out of this case. Mr. Sanner has to withdraw. He can no longer participate in this case. Why on earth would Mr. Horsfield send that letter to American Family telling them, from this point on, you're out of the case, unless they fully intended that American Family was to have nothing to do with the defense of the tort action? I would submit to this court that the evidence goes way beyond clear and convincing to establish that the parties fully agreed that American Family was to have nothing to do with the defense of this action. Now, Ms. Robertson makes a point of saying that the court has to reverse because we agree, and I will stand here and agree with her on this one point, that we did not ever have an agreement with Mr. Moore's counsel that there was to be a consent judgment entered. But that does not require reversal and remand to the trial court. I would cite to the court Supreme Court Rule 84.14, which says that the appellate court shall award a new trial or partial new trial, reverse or affirm the judgment or order of the trial court in whole or in part, or give such judgment as the trial court ought to give. What you simply should do, I would submit to you, is delete that portion of the judgment of the trial court that referred to the consent judgment, because I will freely concede that that was not part of what the evidence is in this case.
Mr. Manners, Ms. Robertson says that relying on testimony where some minor point was left out in an agreement and you say, oh, it was our intent to have it in, or we thought it was understood, is one thing, but where it's a central feature of the agreement, it needs to be reflected somehow in the agreement. You can't just rely on testimony saying, oh yeah, we agreed to that too, that opens it up too much. Can you address that?
What's the point of reformation of contracts then? In my view, obviously, if the contract had been drafted differently, we wouldn't be here. There's a fly that is unduly familiar with me buzzing around here. Ms. Robertson's probably responsible for that. But that's an unfair tactic, I might point out. But obviously, all of us on this side of the table would prefer that that had not been the case. But it strikes me that it goes to the heart of a 537.065 agreement, that if we call it a 537.065 agreement, how do we possibly call this a 537.065 agreement if it does what Ms. Robertson says it is described?
But that's a different question than, yes. There's two arguments you make. One is that it's implicit in an 065 agreement,
yes.
And the other is that it was in fact explicit in the discussions of counsel.
Yes. Well, I don't recall any case that is cited by Ms. Robertson that says that because of the importance of the centrality of the issue that is involved in the agreement, that that somehow makes it inappropriate for reformation. I agree. I would obviously prefer that it would have been somehow hinted at. I will say this. There is repeated reference in the brief of the appellant in this case, and it's underlined several places in the brief of the appellant, that the only time that this agreement would ever become operative is in the event that there is a judgment entered against Mr. Moore, in the event. That's underlined several times. If you look at the actual contract itself, the contract is worded differently. Paragraph 1 of the contract on page 4, numbered paragraph 1, talks about when the judgment is entered, which is a little bit different. There's a subtle difference because the parties obviously contemplated that a judgment was going to be entered against Mr. Moore, rather than that there might be some contingency under which, under some mystical circumstances, it might be possible that a judgment would be entered against Mr. Moore. That is certainly consistent with the idea that we normally associate with the 537.065 agreement, which is that everyone understands a judgment is going to be entered against the tortfeasor.
What was the purpose of the reference in the settlement to Butters and the other case?
Well, I believe it was obviously because everyone recognizes the consideration that is given for the protection of the tortfeasor's assets is that a judgment is going to be entered, which the execution upon which will only be against specified assets, which is why the statute refers to specified assets being the point of the statute. REMCO, of course, articulates that in full bloom, and that is why we cite that in the brief. I think that states as well as I can the substance of the argument. Unless you have additional questions for me, I don't know that I can say anything else other than what I have already. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I did not bring the fly, but I would like his 3 minutes for that. In following up on several things, the court is aware we're under reformation, and reformation is an extraordinary remedy. At the trial, the question was asked specifically, despite what was preferred, what they would have liked to have happened, plaintiff's counsel was asked, why doesn't the written document, which is the 065 agreement, in this trial that we've looked at, contain or talk about language for, quote, an uncontested hearing on underlying damages? Answer, because it was understood between two practicing lawyers with substantial experience, the whole purpose of the 537-065 is to ensure that the insurance company no longer has the ability and right to control the defense. And according to all the case law I've reviewed on the matter, what typically occurs is plaintiff either gets an agreement with the defendant as to a specific amount, or what we are going to do in this case, have an uncontested hearing on liability and damages in front of a judge, and the court make the determination on the amount. That is absolutely what the record reflects. We were very careful on that. It is commonplace that attorneys like myself and like Cheryl and my partner Zach, we negotiate 065s that don't always say what the plaintiff said they preferred or hoped happened in this case. We've given you Reinhart versus Anderson, where the plaintiff and defendant entered into an 065, allowed the plaintiff to take a default on liability, but contested damages. It is a very, very important case for this court's consideration. 065 agreements, when you have a situation like in Butters or in other cases where the insurance company issues a flat denial of coverage, never responds to any agreement to settle, never responds or helps the defendant. The defendant has the opportunity and the possibility to enter into an 065. And this court, it is our hope, issues an opinion that says it's a vehicle that's important and should be construed under the language determined within the agreement, because defendants and plaintiffs make agreements that's very complicated sometimes, and there's consideration. The defendant has to be careful not to have. In this case, there was withdrawal of the reservation of rights letter and then some conduct that occurred in a deck action. Plaintiff's lawyer asked for the withdrawal of the reservation of rights letter at the time of drafting this agreement. You're talking about a defendant that if a defendant, and I have counseled defendants who sometimes within the agreement have agreed to continue, and I have agreed to and have defended defendants under an 065 to have no liability. It is not in the statute. It's not in the case law that it is required of a defendant to agree to a uncontested hearing, and it is absolutely not the law in this state that if an 065 is entered into, a plaintiff gets a judgment. That is not the law, and that is not the agreement. The agreement says any judgment entered.
The question raised by Judge Stith initially was, you're arguing the agreements generally, but doesn't this case come down to, are there facts in this case from which the trial court could believe that there was an intent to have additional provisions? Not should all agreements have additional provisions, but in this case, was there an intention and an agreement to have it?
And I have, in answering your question, if I'm out of my time, but you asked the question, so I will answer. We have made that argument in response to their argument that it is implicit and implied in every agreement. And so we have raised that not just because we want it stated as the law, but it is the law conversely. It is not required, but that was also in refutation of the plaintiff's position that it is. Sure. Going directly to your question, the issue of reformation and what it has always been is that there is nothing wrong with the document as worded and no mistake that ever occurred. You have a situation where, at best, they said they talked about it, but no reason why it was never included in the document. There's nothing wrong. There's no mistaken fact upon which a party relied. There's no mistaken there's no reliance upon conduct entered into by a party. So at the end of your, to answer your question, where we begin and end is this is a reformation action. It's an extraordinary remedy. And yes, the standard of review is relevant, of course, as it is in every case. But you're talking about reforming the very essence and nature of the agreement by terms which there is no mistake in the plaintiff's lawyer in why it wasn't contained therein. And in the absence of an agreement by the defendant, of which you have reformation cases where both sides are in agreement and someone else is trying to come in and interfere with what was intended, or you have a mistake within the document. Here you have no mistake. No reliance. You have nothing wrong with anything that they did. They just simply, for at best, chose for some reason not to put it in there. And
would this be different if both counsels said, yes, we talked about that and that was our intent?
If Mr. Moore, either himself or his counsel, had testified, we absolutely agree to it and we want that reformed, there are cases that would support that being reformed.
Well, but here's what I don't understand about that. What I don't understand about that is we let the jury and the trial judge believe all part or none of the evidence in every case. Just because two people said it, the trial court wouldn't have to believe it.
And you're talking about, again, to go to the essential nature of reforming a written agreement by someone who says, yeah, we talked about it. The reason we talk about the 065 is it is in reality, these are entered into on a daily or weekly basis. It is a very dangerous proposition with being sensitive to the standard of review that you can enter into an 065 and be absolutely silent on the three most critical things. How am I supposed to, I'm actually going to counsel a defendant to not put that in? Wonder if Mr. Moore did not agree to that. You're going to say, well, plaintiff's lawyer said so. Though what the appellant's position is, 065s are very important. They're also very, very critical in terms of what the party's rights are. And if you want reformation, an extraordinary remedy to reform the essential nature of it, then it is something that requires more than, it's a dangerous proposition. You're going to go on a plaintiff's lawyer saying, we agreed, and a trial judge, we have been very careful to defer to the credibility of Judge Dowd, who said, I don't find Mr. Horsfield credible on that. Where is the standard for mutual mistake? At the end of the day, it is not whether you agree to something. That's not enough alone to support reformation of an 065, because if you do that, then the plaintiff will give one to the defendant, and maybe the defendant agreed, and maybe the defendant did not agree. It is a case where it is our hope that the court enforces those according to the written agreement, because they are critical rights. Thank you for the additional time. I did use your 3 minutes. Thank you for the additional time.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.